Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Carlin Appy, and this is the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society podcast. Welcome to the channel, and thanks very, very much for joining me today. And I'm particularly excited that you're joining me today because I'm really excited to share this book with you. So I just talked with Michael Robinson about his new book, The Lost White Tribe: Explorers, Scientists, and the Theory That Changed a Continent. This came out with Oxford University Press just this year in 2016. And it's a book that, as you'll hear us talking about in a moment, is a page turner. I mean, you get to the end of each chapter and you need to start the next one. It's written with such a beautiful attentiveness to the craft of writing that it really, truly is a pleasure to read, as well as being a fascinating account of the interweaving of different forms of inquiry and forms of evidence around the life story of a particular hypothesis, a particular idea in the history of science and archaeology and linguistics and physical anthropology and biblical studies and a whole lot more. So what the story does, and you'll kind of hear about this in a moment, it starts us off in the mansion of a particular figure. This is Henry Morton Stanley, who you'll hear about in a moment, who was a very famous explorer who had encountered what the book calls the white race of Gambara Gara. This is something that has largely been forgotten. It makes people uncomfortable. But as the book shows, this idea, this notion of a white race of Gambara Gara, this is a mountain in Africa, winds up being the fulcrum around which any number of related and some seemingly unrelated ideas about humanity, about genealogy, about human identity are all constellated in super fascinating ways. So Stanley was going to Africa to find the source of the Nile, and his trip captures the world's attention, and it informs a larger set of questions that animate the book. Where did the human species originate? Why had it split into separate races? And how had these races come to settle the different regions of the planet? Now, as these questions get explored, you'll see that the story touches on biblical references. It touches on the study of mummies, the study of skulls, the writing of adventure stories, the dreams of Freud. It's by the end of the story, it touches on sort of major tribal conflict in the modern world. It touches on issues of repatriation. It touches on the case of the Tarim mummies for scholars and listeners and readers who followed that case as it played out in China. There's lots of ways that this story really animates a number of different fields of inquiry. And so with that, it's such a rich book. And it's such an interesting, I think what Michael has to say is really, really interesting. I'm going to leave you to it and just say thank you so much for listening. Thank you for your support of the channel. And really, really, really go out and get your hands on a copy of this book. You won't be sorry. It's just fabulously interesting. It's such a pleasure to read. You can read this in the bathtub as well as at your desk. And I hope you enjoy that. And I also hope you enjoy the conversation. Thanks for listening. I'm here today to talk with Michael Robinson about his new book, The Lost White Tribe. Welcome to New Books in STS, Michael, and thanks very much both for writing such a superbly written book. And I'm not being hyperbolic there. It's really a beautiful book. It's a page turner of a book, and also for making time to talk with me today. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Carla.
So let's start, as is traditional for the channel, by talking about what brought you to the field. And in short, why the history of science? What brought you to the history of science?
Well, you've probably heard this from a lot of your history of science people, but I did not start as a history of science undergrad. I studied biology and philosophy in college and assumed that I would be probably a researcher in a lab, which I did for a couple of years after I finished college, and kind of figured out there that the aspect that I most liked about science was not sitting at a lab bench, but really the process of discovery. So after doing a number of different things, when I kind of came back to the idea of grad school, I went to a history of science program because I was just really interested in that. And then I also kind of assumed that I'd be looking into late 20th century biology. That was the stuff that I found so interesting. But when I went to Wisconsin, where I did my grad studies, I was with Lynn Neihart. I was her advisee. And Lynn, as a lot of historians of science probably know, does 19th century biology. So I tended to veer more towards the 19th century than the 20th and just kind of fell in love with it, particularly the outdoor aspect of it. I think I had always associated science as an indoor thing, and going to the 19th century, you're kind of coming up against all of these amazing stories about people going places and finding things, and so I just fell in love with that aspect of it.
Great. Now, the subtitle of the book that we're talking about is Explorers, Scientists, and the Theory That Changed a Continent. And we'll talk about all of those roles and what all of those components mean in the hour to come. But first, what brought you to this particular focus for this project? And at the same time, how did you decide to write in this way for this kind of audience when you were writing about this topic and shaping this project?
So on the first question, how I kind of came up with this project, I had in 2006, I published a book called The Coldest Crucible, which was about Arctic exploration and American culture. And that book really kind of traced the arc of United States' interest in the Arctic as a place and the expeditions that took people to the Arctic to discover various things. And so at a very late point in that project, I started running into these stories that I really didn't know what to do with. And the one story in particular that I found was one by a Canadian anthropologist explorer by the name of Vilmer Stefansson. Stefansson went up to the Arctic in 1910 to 1912 and came back reporting that he had found blonde Eskimos. And when I read this, it just seemed so completely absurd that I had to dig a little further and found that people were completely captivated with the story about blonde Eskimos. Half of the people who wrote about it seemed to think that Stefansson was completely making it up and this was a fraud. And the other half spent their time trying to figure out, well, where did these white Eskimos come from? Are they Irish? Are they lost Vikings? Are they, you know, the descendants of the Franklin expedition? I mean, so, but I really didn't have anything to do with it. So I just kind of tucked it in a file. And then over the years, really over the last 10 years, I just kept running into more and more of these stories of discoveries of so-called white tribes. So by the time I kind of filled up a couple of file cabinets with stuff about white tribes by about 2008, 2009, I said, I think I have to do something with this. So this book is kind of a reflection of that. Oh, and on your second question of why did I write it the way that I did, do you mean in terms of the number of chapters?
So what I mean is that, at least from my perspective as one reader, the book very much reads as something that can be usefully and productively read both by experts in the field, right? I mean, I was completely unaware of this story, and I feel like as a kind of professional historian of science, whatever that means, I got a lot out of it, but also this is something that someone who knows nothing about history, nothing about history of science, can pick up, can read, can enjoy. And so it feels to me like the kind of book that's very much, it feels intended as something that can be read and enjoyed by a very wide non-specialist audience as well. And that's a very particular approach to writing, and it's a very particular kind of decision to pay attention to that aspect of the craft, right? Transitions between paragraphs, like the plot arc. I mean, you've clearly thought and worked really hard about that or on that. So that's kind of what I mean, the sort of writing it in a way that it reads as if you took the writing of it really, really seriously, which is not always or necessarily often the case for a history book.
Well, thank you. First of all, I appreciate that it reads that way. A lot of my experiences in writing this book grew out of writing my first book, which was essentially a revision of my dissertation, my PhD dissertation. And, you know, there's so much, as you know, that we learn in graduate school about writing to a particular discipline, that when we kind of move outside of that or move beyond graduate school into a broader universe of readers and audiences, you know, from undergraduates or graduate students or the radio or podcasts or whatever, that I found that I was constantly kind of trying to connect to these broader audiences. And I think I've had a blog for about 6 years now, and that really helped in terms of trying to move beyond the 20 or 30 people who do what I do. And I also think I really kind of care about writing. I know that when I'm reading a book and I feel like I'm finishing a chapter and there's some really amazing hook at the end of the chapter, and I'm like, damn, they did it to me. I have to read the next chapter. And so this was a kind of experiment, actually, in trying to write that way, to try to write a story that, you know, carries you forward like a bag of Doritos. You just can't, you can't stop. So it was an experiment that way. And so I appreciate that you thought it worked.
Do you have any, or did you have any models in mind of other writers whose style was really effective for you in that way, that you kind of kept in mind as exemplars?
I do. You know, a book that made a big impact on me before I went to graduate school was Into the Wild by John Krakauer, and Into Thin Air also I read a little bit later. Sebastian Junger's book. All of these, you know, these are kind of creative nonfiction, I guess, adventure, you could say, if you wanted to put that into a genre. But there's an incredible amount of craft that goes into writing those kinds of books. And what I always admired, and, you know, Joseph Ellis, actually, also in terms of someone within the historical discipline, I think does a really good job of this. But writing in a way that you have a narrative that's pulling you forward, and then, in a sense, the author raises questions that cannot be answered by taking the narrative from point A to point B chronologically. So they have to take a little breather and write a chapter about whatever subject is kind of looming. I almost think of it almost like a Christmas tree. Like, you've got, you know, from afar, if you look at a Christmas tree, it's like, oh, it's pretty. It kind of goes up and then it comes back down. And as you get closer, you're like, yeah, but you know what's really cool is like all of these little ornaments, you know. And the more that you look at the tree, the more you kind of become fascinated with the ornaments. And so I guess I wanted to write something where I felt we had to kind of go in and occasionally study some of these ornaments and then come back out again and look at the broad broad picture. So it was an attempt to kind of, to do that in a chronological form.
Awesome. So let's get right into it. So the introduction opens with an account of reporter David Kerr in 1885 going to the London mansion of Henry Morton Stanley to interview him. Now, at this point, Stanley, as you tell us early on in this chapter, was the world's most famous explorer. He's also absolutely central to the story as we move forward, and he seems like a super fascinating character. So as a way to kind of launch us into the story, what do we need to understand and what do you think is important for us to understand about Stanley as a person? Like in order to kind of lay the groundwork for what's to come with his ideas and his explorations.
Stanley was born in Wales. He had a pretty unstable adolescence. He was brought up in an orphanage, although his mom was still alive. He, as a young man, migrated to the United States, kicked around doing a bunch of different things. He was a Confederate soldier for a while. Eventually got into the newspaper business and started working for the New York Herald in the 1850s. And at that time, the Herald was fantastically popular. It was probably the most influential newspaper in the United States. And it was run by a guy named James Gordon Bennett, who is, something between Donald Trump and Rupert Murdoch, I think, in the 19th century. It's a guy who was incredibly successful, but ruthless in how he pursued stories, and who came up with the idea that the best way to cover the news was to generate news. So Stanley started working for him, and he became a war correspondent. He did stories from all over the world. And so Stanley got the idea that, you know, there was this missionary, David Livingstone, who had been working in southern Africa for many years and trying to convert people to Christianity, and had gone missing. The reports coming out of Africa, the reports from David Livingstone just stopped. And so together they figured out a way, like, let's send Stanley in looking for him. And so so Stanley is the guy who actually finds Livingstone in the early 1860s. And that turns him into this fabulously well-known explorer. It became a news story all over the world, especially since the Herald had such reach as a newspaper. But I think, going back to your question, Stanley, although he had achieved an enormous amount of fame by the time he was in his 40s, he was an incredibly insecure guy. Because of his background, he was actually, Stanley was kind of a pen name for him. He had always felt insecure, especially as he kind of moved up higher through the various social classes, that he was looked down upon by British people of peerage. He was looked down upon by American people of wealth. And so he was very thin-skinned and suspicious of a lot of people. He was a very lonely man through large portions of his life, and spent a lot of time embellishing his own record, I think, to kind of make up for his insecurities. So he's a complicated guy. Yeah.
Okay. Now, you talk in chapter 3 about this quest, right, that Stanley goes on to find Livingstone, and he eventually finds Livingstone, and listeners may be familiar with the famous, perhaps apocryphal, who knows, quote, Dr. Livingstone, I presume, right?
Right.
They meet, and they go traveling together. Now, as they're traveling together, they're visited by a man named Mukamba, the ruler of the Uzige, and Mukamba tells them that a white race lives north of Lake Tanganyika in the lands west of Lake Victoria.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, soon after in the story, Stanley actually reports, and then he writes about as well, having seen this race of white Africans, the Gambara Garans. I love saying that. Gambara Garans. Okay. So this is actually, I mean, this is at the heart of the story, or this is one of the focal points of the story. Stanley claims to have seen these white Africans at the Gambara Gardens. So we need to talk about this. So let's actually kind of go there. What happened, basically? What's going on? What does he claim to have seen? And why does this take off so broadly and so widely, really worldwide, in terms of this kind of excitement over this and interest in this?
So Stanley, after he finds Livingston, comes back to the United States. And this was such a spectacular success for the New York Herald that immediately James Gordon Bennett is trying to figure out a way to get Stanley back in the field, and so he could generate more money for his newspaper. And the biggest issue at the time, dealing with Africa at least, was the discovery of the source of the Nile. This is something that had been of interest to people for 2,000 years. I mean, we have reports, you know, that also kind of perhaps apocryphal, that Julius Caesar thought this was the most interesting question. Where does the Nile begin? And in the 1850s and 1860s, a number of explorers, particularly British explorers, had spent a lot of time in the lakes region of East Africa, what we would now call the Rift Valley, looking at various lakes, trying to identify the kind of network, the circulatory system of this the lakes region, to try to figure out where the lakes began. And so in 1874, Stanley leaves for Africa a second time, this time trying to essentially figure out this mystery of geography. And he makes it to Lake Victoria. He does a he goes all the way around the perimeter of Victoria. He meets a very powerful king, King Mutesa. And it's with Mutesa's, essentially Mutesa gives him an army of 2,000 men to travel further west in search of other lakes. And it's at this point that Stanley notices that some of the people in this massive army of King Mutesa, who's the king of Buganda, are very, very light skinned. They don't look like the other Africans, the other East Africans in this group. And he asks them where they came from. They're very uncommunicative with him. So he asks some of the African generals, and they say that these people are, as you said, from Gambara Gara, which is a region in the west where there's a very, very high mountain with snow on the top, and that the people of Gambara Gara, who are extremely light-skinned, live on this mountain, and they raise cows, and they eat bananas and drink milk. And if anyone comes to threaten them, they go to the top of this mountain where there's this crater lake, and they live. So it's this kind of really it just has the ring of myth about it. So Stanley doesn't take it entirely seriously, but as they head west, sure enough, on the horizon, he sees this massive mountain that no one's ever seen that's capped in snow. And he gets to within about 20 miles of it. And so in a sense, pieces of this story start to come together for him. And you can see from his writings that it becomes more and more of a preoccupation. He goes to East Africa with this kind of geographical mystery, but he ends leaving the continent with a kind of anthropological mystery. Who are these people? How did they get on the mountain? Is the story really true? And how do I get back there to figure it out?
Thank you. Dun, dun, dun. Okay. So meanwhile, like, Stanley's reports of this white tribe of Africans is one of the reasons that this is being taken up. And this is sort of, so many people have such interest in this, is that it articulates with a broader interest in the genealogy of human races that was ultimately based in a biblical context. This is really, really important. Now here, we need to get into who Ham is and what he has to do with all of this. All right, so Ham, just super brief, quick and dirty, and you can flesh this out if you want to. Ham is one of the sons of Noah. Long story short, in a chapter that fleshes this out in great detail, chapter 5, The Curse of Ham, he gets cursed, okay? And he becomes associated with blackness and with slavery. And the curse of Ham provides biblical justifications for slavery and for black slavery in particular for many, many years. Now, this becomes really, really important because really early on in the book, you describe the book as a biography of an idea. idea. And that idea is the life story of the Hamitic hypothesis from Ham. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Michael, I'm going to hit this back to you. What is the Hamitic hypothesis, and what does it have to do with the possibility of a sort of white tribe of Africans in Gambara-Gara?
So I guess the easiest way to kind of to dive into this was really, if you go back to the 1600s and 1700s, it's a period of time when Europeans are coming into contact with people all over the world. Yet it's also a time that's very, very influenced by the Judeo-Christian scriptures, the Bible, and the history of Genesis and Exodus really become the framework, and then this goes back actually long before that, really to the early Middle Ages, becomes a framework for trying to understand anthropology. So, for example, if you run into people who don't look like you, then how do you explain their difference? And for Christians, and I should say this isn't just for Christians, it's for Jews and Muslims as well in the Mediterranean region, the scriptures become a way of trying to identify where people came from. Now, most people believed that all human beings of whatever color and creed were from a common descent, ultimately from Adam and Eve. But most people in the Middle Ages didn't really bother much with trying to trace a lineage all the way back to Adam and Eve, because in Genesis 8 and Genesis 9, the world is destroyed in a flood. And the only survivors from that flood, the only human survivors, are Noah and his three sons and their families. So for people in the Middle Ages and later centuries who are trying to figure out, well, how are we connected to these people we keep running into? They look to the story of Noah, not to Adam and Eve. And in particular, the story of Ham becomes very interesting. First of all, because there are three sons, it correlated well with what was known by Europeans of the rest of the world, which was that there were three major continents. And so they liked the kind of symmetry and correlation between three suns and three continents. So you start seeing on maps, each of the suns is essentially given a continent as to be the forefather of the people of that continent. And Ham was usually identified with Africa. Not exclusively identified with Africa. There were many people who saw Ham as being, let's say, the forefather of the people of Asia. But in any event, in the 1500s, as the Atlantic slave trade begins to catch fire, people looked at the story of Genesis and said, you know, the interesting thing about Ham is that he's actually cursed by his father. And within the story, Noah, having, you know, successfully navigated through the waters of the flood, lands on Mount Ararat. He starts a vineyard, drinks either knowingly or unknowingly the grape juice from this vineyard, and promptly gets drunk and ends up passed out naked in his tent. And Ham is the one who finds him. Ham immediately reports this to his brothers. His brothers come to clothe their father. They clothe their father in a cloak without looking at them.
They approach him backwards or something, right? So,
yes.
So like he goes in and he's like, dudes, dad's naked. I mean, like basically, and the other two sons are like, oh no, we can't look at dad naked, and they clothe him. And then like dad wakes up and he's like, you're cursed.
That's right.
Basically, right?
You know, it's just a story that happens to every son and their father.
Who hasn't experienced this, I'm sure.
Right, exactly. So Ham tells his brothers, they clothe their father without looking at him. Noah wakes up and immediately curses Ham. Now, this is very strange. Why would he actually says, cursed be you, Ham, and your son Canaan. May you forever be the slaves of your brothers. So why is he cursing? Maybe he's hungover. He's just in a really bad mood. I don't know. But what seems to be the case, at least this is what a lot of kind of biblical exegesis thinks, is that this story of the curse of Ham really derives from a much earlier story, the fragments of which we don't really understand culturally. So it could be that there was a prohibition against nakedness, that to see a parent figure naked is to in a sense, emasculate them. There's all kinds of theories about why. But in the end, Ham and his son Canaan are cursed by Noah. And that's actually all it says. There's nothing in Genesis that talks about race. There's nothing that talks about slavery. But for later generations that were using the Bible as a kind of map of global anthropology, they looked at this story and said, oh, this must be the Africans. That's why they're black. They've been cursed with blackness. And then in the 1500s, and clearly they were cursed with slavery as well. So it became a kind of justification for many Europeans for their treatment of Africans after about the year 1500.
So as we move through this story, this layer of biblical biblical reference as a source of evidence or a source of engagement gets fleshed out by increasing other kinds of evidence that start coming into this story. One of them is linguistic evidence. And this brings us to a really fascinating guy who gives his at least nickname to chapter six, Oriental Jones. And this is British polymath William Jones, who brings the study of language into play in trying to understand ancient history. Now, he goes to India and eventually becomes interested in Sanskrit, and he becomes convinced that Sanskrit is going to help unlock a common heritage between the people of India, Greece, and Egypt. Now, this becomes important as we look at the development of this Hamitic hypothesis, because his ideas are going to help reframe the Hamitic family as a source of progress rather than degradation, sort of the origin of empires. So for you, what are you most interested in when you think about William Jones and his study of language?
I guess the thing that I find most interesting about Jones, and this also goes for a couple of chapters after that with other people, is that they exist in, you know, they're 18th century scholars who, in a sense, they look at the way that Europeans have understood history as being attached very, very closely to biblical history. And they exist at a time when it's encouraged, in fact, to say, well, are there other sources? What else is there? And so in the case of Jones, Jones is a great, great lover of language. And in fact, the languages he loves most are the dead languages, the languages that are no longer spoken, Persian or Latin or Sanskrit. And his goal in understanding these languages is not just, I mean, part of it is that he just finds them beautiful. And one of his favorite things to do to translate in these languages is actually poetry. So he's kind of enraptured by the process of kind of understanding these early cultures through their language. But because he's read so much and because he's able to look at it synthetically and from a kind of meta level, he starts seeing similarities between languages. And as he does this, he really comes up with this kind of root idea of Indo-European languages, the idea that Sanskrit, which he learns when he's in India in the 1770s, is connected structurally with other ancient languages like Persian, Latin, ancient Greek, perhaps even Gaelic. And from this, he believes that, well, these must have been daughter languages of the original language. And because he's a religious guy and still influenced by this kind of scriptural story of history, he associates this with Noah and his three sons. So he kind of grafts what we would call historical philology. Well, that's what it was called at the time, or today we would call it linguistics. He kind of attaches this very kind of esoteric and academic field with biblical history. He doesn't try to use one against the other. He tries to use one to augment the other. But in so doing, kind of refreshes the idea of the Hamitic hypothesis.
Great. Now, in addition to linguistics, we also see in this part of the book physical anthropology kind of coming into the story. And there's all kinds of ways that this happens, and we'll just kind of barely touch on them. So as we move forward into the story, we see the concept and the term Caucasian coming into the conversation first as a kind of place and then as a way to talk about race. And we see people working with skulls and mummies as a way to think about and provide explanatory tools for arguing for particular ways of thinking about human origins. Now, in the middle of the 19th century, support for this Hamitic hypothesis begins to wane, but it's then, as you show here in chapter 8 and then onward, rescued, transformed, and then championed by scientists. Now, there's new evidence for this hypothesis that comes out of the study of human skulls, and long story short, it sort of gives flesh to this idea of the Hamite as a Caucasian invader in Africa. Okay. So we start having the development of this idea of a Caucasian or white invader or conqueror from outside of Africa that comes into Africa. And this becomes really important for all kinds of reasons. One of the ways this plays out is in this the kind of discovery and study of something called the Great Zimbabwe. All right. So this is interesting and important in part because we're going to come back to it in the second part of the book. But for you, what's interesting for us to know about what you are most interested in terms of this idea and object, the Great Zimbabwe? It's not a magician. It's not somebody. I think of Johnny Carson, right? Like kind of sitting and the Great Zimbabwe. It's not that. So what is it, Michael, and why is it important?
So Great Zimbabwe is the largest structure that largest ancient structure in Africa south of the pyramids. So if the pyramids are the kind of largest human structure in the entire continent, Great Zimbabwe is a close second. What it is basically the site of a city in Zimbabwe itself built by in the 1400s. The structures of Great Zimbabwe, most of what you see are granite courses, walls, intricately laid granite course walls, some that are 30 feet high and 20 feet thick at some points. And this city winds through this valley as well as on the hilltops around it. And it was something that was, it had been since the 1500s when the Portuguese began moving down the course of Africa on their expeditions in search of a route to Asia. They had heard reports of a city in the interior, an incredibly fabulous city. And the Portuguese, seeing this also through the lens of their own Judeo-Christian background, associated with King Solomon. Oh, perhaps this was the gold mines of King Solomon, and perhaps this was his city. And so ultimately in the 1860s, this city is rediscovered by a German anthropologist, by a guy named Karl Moch. And Moch, when he sees this city, immediately associates it with King Solomon, somebody who is not of African descent. And so from that point onward, Great Zimbabwe, even though it's literally 2,000 miles, actually more than that, from the Middle East, and it's really in the southern, Africa, is seen as something that could not have been created by Africans. Africans could not have been within the thinking of the time. We're not sophisticated enough to build such fabulously complicated and beautiful structures. So Zimbabwe, this amazing site, is essentially taken from the culture of Africa and implanted as something that was of Mediterranean heritage or European heritage even. And that fit. So I guess to kind of back up a little bit, what you begin to see is you have this ancient biblical story of migrations out of the Middle East or, let's say, Central Asia into Africa and other parts of the world. That was where the origin of the human species came from, as told through Genesis. And now, in the middle of the 1800s, you have these other branches that begin to essentially affirm parts of that story, with Jones talking about linguistics and the rise of Indo-European language. And now, with these stories of archaeology, which show these ancient ruins that within the minds of people at the time could not have been built by indigenous peoples, and so therefore are evidence of a white migration in the ancient past.
Now, there's also another thread of evidence that comes into this story here in the first part of the book, and we won't have time to talk at much length about it, but I just want to kind of mention it for listeners. We actually come back to this figure of King Mutesa that you mentioned a little bit earlier. And there's a really interesting account here about the way that he actually knew about Ham, right, before coming into contact with the protagonist of our story, or at least our early story, Stanley. And one of the reasons for that is that there's this Johnny Appleseed, as you call him, of the Hamitic hypothesis in East Africa. And there are stories that begin circulating even before Stanley gets there about convergences between kind of kingship stories of Buganda and the story of Ham. They link a figure called Kintu, the original man who had arrived in the Lakes region from the north, to Ham. There's all kinds of ways in which this happens. And I mention it here in particular because this adds another kind of evidence to the story. And this is the evidence of oral traditions of African mm-hmm. societies. And so there's a really interesting part of the story that takes those seriously as well as part of the narrative of kind of what gets us from the beginning to the end of the story. Mm-hmm. Did you want to add before?
Sure, absolutely. The hardest thing for me to do in this book, it really was the hardest, was to explain this transition that the Hamitic hypothesis makes in the later part of the 19th century, from going to a story which explains why where Africans came from, right, that they are essentially the progeny of Ham and cursed with blackness, to this idea of Hamites as actually being white invaders of Africa. There's a flip that happens in the 1840s and 1850s. It's a little bit complicated, but basically what it is there's a group of scientists and what we would call anthropologists who believe that that the various races of the human species are not related to each other, that they were formed independently. This was called polygenism. And so the way that some people try to explain the story of the Bible, which would somehow allow for this to work, because the Bible makes it seem like we're all essentially the children of Adam and Eve. And the only way to make sense of this was for these individuals to say, oh, well, the things that you're reading in Genesis are true, but they only relate to the history of Europeans, that essentially the story of the Bible is the story of white people. And it was that flip that suddenly transforms this idea of Hamites as black into Hamites as these white invaders from other parts of the world that come rolling into Africa at some point in the ancient past and conquer or intermarry with people there. And so it's at this moment that this transition is happening, that explorers are beginning to read this literature, this new racial literature of white invasions. In particular, John Speke, who, as you mentioned, is this kind of Johnny Appleseed of the Hamitic hypothesis. And as he's moving through the Lakes region trying to find the source of the Nile, he's looking at Africans that he's encountering, and he's saying, yep, that guy is definitely white, or is somehow the offspring of people of white invaders from the ancient past. And he attaches whiteness not to all Africans that he encounters, but to the royal clans that he encounters. So when he's with royalty of a particular area, he comments a great deal on their high cheekbones and their long noses and how they were the descendants of the Hamites. And so Mutesa is one of the people who he essentially points to and says, you're one of this royal clan of white people. So the story of Ham was actually related to Mutesa through his encounters with earlier explorers, and perhaps even as early as Muslim or Arab merchants who had moved into the interior even before the Europeans arrived in the 1840s. So these stories of, essentially like invaders from other places and the story of Ham and his brothers were beginning to be known to East Africans even before Stanley arrives. And when Stanley arrives, that's this moment when, as you put it, all of it begins to get put together. It's like now we have evidence from the Bible, from physical anthropology, from linguistics, physics. And hey, there's oral testimony because these stories of white invaders connect in kind of strange ways to the African origin stories of East Africa, especially around the figure of Kintu, who is seen as the original man.
Now, this way of thinking about the Hamitic hypothesis in terms of an invasion is something that's very interestingly developed in the second part of the book. So there are a number of chapters that look at this in detail, in particular in the context in chapter 13 of the rise of what's called the Aryan invasion theory. And we're going to come back to that and the sort of consequences of that in a moment. We also see the development of this moment of with the blonde Eskimos, right? We started our conversation with the blonde Eskimos in chapter 14, really takes us into that, and not just Filmer Stephenson's encounter with these blonde Eskimos in the Canadian Arctic, but also the ways that that encounter reverberated with the encounters of others who also claimed to have found white races, including white Indians in Panama, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The story gets really interesting for me in other ways when we start to look at the kind of fictions that we can think about fictions just as sort of created things in the context of this whole story, but adventure fiction that comes into the story in chapter 15 and 16. So we go back to King Solomon, and specifically we go to a book called King Solomon's Mines in chapter 15. This is H. Rider Haggard's book of 1885, which along with two other works, Alan Quatermain and She, that Haggard also wrote, established, in the words of the book, a new genre of adventure fiction called lost race literature. Now, there's all kinds of amazing things that are happening in this part of the story. You talk about the broader context of Victorian novelists who are writing about lost Europeans and Mediterraneans relatively frequently. Why would that have been? How does this articulate with broader ideas and concerns about human difference and ideas thereof? And this takes on really interesting relevance when we get to the next chapter, because it wasn't just a kind of broad wide readership that was reading Haggard's work. It was also people like Sigmund Freud.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about Freud, because this is actually a super fascinating part of the story. I was really surprised to see this here. And it's just really interesting. So can you say a little bit about Freud and Jung and what they're doing here in this story, here around kind of chapter 16-ish of the narrative?
Sure. So H. Rider Haggard is really studying to be a lawyer. But he goes to Africa. He was not a very good student. He goes to Africa. He works for the colonial administration in the Transvaal. He encounters a lot of these stories. He learns, for example, about the discovery or rediscovery of Great Zimbabwe, and also about the Hamitic hypothesis. And when he comes back to Europe to begin a life as a jurist, he decides, I'm actually going to give it a go as a novelist first and try to write novels. And he originally writes a couple of kind of serious high fiction novels that really don't go anywhere. And then he's really kind of fascinated with the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, as well as Treasure Island, and says, I'm going to give it a go to write adventure literature. And so he sets up a story, King Solomon's Mine, on the rediscovery of a great Zimbabwe-like place where there's a culture which it comes from some place outside of Africa, and they're fabulously wealthy mines. There's a witch character, and this story goes, it's spectacularly successful. I mean, it's like the Harry Potter of, the 1880s, and it brings him incredible, wealth as well as a reputation. And Haggard is a guy who, once this thing kind of explodes, He thinks he's figured out the formula, which is just to write as fast as he possibly can. He tries to edit almost nothing that he writes, and his stories show that kind of haste. I mean, he definitely needed a better editor than he had. But at the same time, because Haggard's rolling through this stuff so quickly, in a way, it almost becomes a kind of, I don't know. I mean, I almost tend to think that Haggard, writing so quickly, doesn't edit himself, maybe stuff that he should have edited. In other words, he gets to these really kind of dark places. The European protagonists who go into Africa and find lost races end up being really transformed by their experience. There are these kind of atavistic things that happen to the Europeans that go to Africa. They start becoming savage. There are characters within these, especially the figure of Shi, for example, who's essentially a white Persian princess with supernatural powers, who is runs this colony in the heart of Africa. And in this place, there are all of these crazy things that happen: necrophilia, cannibalism, homosexuality, which at the time was seen as, akin to that stuff. And so all of these things were seen as very titillating by Victorian audiences, but they were also, and I should say, what was titillating about them was not merely this description of essentially forbidden acts or forbidden behaviors, but it was forbidden behaviors that was attached to people who are racially white. And this was not lost on the first generation of psychoanalysts. So Freud, for example, was a big reader of Haggard. In fact, he prescribed Haggard to his patients who he felt had repressed certain memories that they needed to get in touch with. And in fact, this idea of essentially lost white tribes in Africa who are somehow connecting to this deeper, atavistic past or behavior, connected very well with Freud's own theories of the human psyche, which he believed was a kind of onion, where you had a primitive brain, which was overlaid by increasingly more conscious and more sophisticated layers of mind. But that this connection between the higher layers and the lower layers, between the id, for example, and the superego, were echoed in this literature by Haggard. And so that's really where you see the connection. Mm-hmm.
So the story continues to be really, really interesting. And you take us also here in the same chapter into Carl Jung's exploration of Africa and search of the primitive, right? This is the way the chapter puts it. And you talk about Jung in terms of his discovery of, quote, the white psyche in the heart of Africa. So there's a really interesting part of the story here. Now, we don't have time to talk about every fascinating thing that's happening in every one of the chapters after this. So I will just briefly touch upon some of the highlights and sort of try to bring us toward something like a conclusion. So soon after this, we have English archaeologist Gertrude Caton Thompson.
Caton Thompson.
Gertrude Caton Thompson, who comes into this whole Great Zimbabwe thing and is basically like, you guys are wrong. These are African in origin. And she basically solves the mystery. She drops the mic. And this is a devastating blow to the Hamitic hypothesis. We also see, and this is something that I want to ask you to talk a little bit about, and then we'll sort of move forward from here. We see a really disturbing, really momentous, and really important way that the kind of Aryan theory here, in particular, something called some version of it called Nordic race theory, is taken up by the Nazis, right? Mm-hmm. In really disturbing and really damaging ways. And what's happening here winds up in the context of post-World War II, really transforming attitudes toward the Hamitic hypothesis as a result. So we see a real transformation after World War II of attitudes toward the search for lost races, toward this Hamitic hypothesis, in part because of what's happening during the war in terms of Nazi engagements with these ideas. So did you want to kind of briefly speak to what you think is most important about that?
Sure. I think the thing that I realized in the writing of this book that I didn't realize at the beginning was I knew this was going to be a story that dealt with the issue of race and theories of race in a serious way. I didn't realize at the outset how profoundly expansive this idea of Aryan invasion was decades and decades before, Nazi Germany discovers this in the 1930s. And so really, you know, by the turn of the century, the beginning of the 20th century, you've got people all over the world who are identified as either indigenous or Aryan, as people of color or people who are Aryan. And so the idea of Aryan, you know, the Aryan originally meant had a linguistic significance. It identified somebody as a speaker of an Indo-European language. But by the beginning of the 20th century, it becomes essentially converted to a racial category, a kind of sister term to the term Caucasian. And so all over the world, you know, from New Zealand and Hawaii to Peru to Panama, you have people identified as Proto-Aryan or Hamitic, which was a kind of synonym for that. And in a sense, what happens in the 1930s is this idea of an Aryan invasion gets shifted. So now we have the story, you know, the story that had been told was that, well, there was this group of Aryans in Central Asia, who then migrated to other parts of the world, kind of like we see in the Bible. And that they populated Europe and they populated India. And that's why we see examples of similarities between the languages. But then there's this strange reversal of that theory called the Nordic race theory in the early 20th century, which says, no, you got it right with the connections, but you got it wrong in terms of place of origin. The place of origin was really Northern Germany or Scandinavia. That's where the white people came from. And then they basically kicked ass over all the other people of the world over the next, you know, the centuries to come. And this was an operating idea for Himmler and the Ananarbe, his research arm. And they went looking for white tribes in Tibet, for example. And so what's really kind of eerie, and you kind of put, I thought you put this well, Carla, it's very disturbing, but there's this strange connection between these ancient maps of racial migration that were kind of put together in the late 1800s, and they map very neatly with the Nazi invasion of of Poland and Eastern Europe and Russia in Operation Barbarossa in the 1940s. I mean, you can almost overlay the maps. I'm not trying to say that, you know, that Hitler was kind of inspired by the Hamitic hypothesis to invade, but you can see how nicely the two segue for people who, you know, wanted to convince themselves that Nazi racial science was legitimate. Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a ton of other material that we can talk about, right, and that we're not going to have a chance to do in detail. There's a whole chapter that talks about the discovery of Kennewick Man, this 9,500-year-old skeleton found in Kennewick, Washington, that takes us really interestingly into arguments for repatriation and identity. There's also a shout-out and a kind of cameo here by Victor Mayer, so I have to mention that, right, because of East Asian Studies, historian. And the chapter 20 also talks about, brings us back to mummies, basically, and talks about Victor Mayer's experience with the remains of Churchin Man in China, and the kind of case of the Tarim mummies that got a lot of press fairly recently. And so listeners who are interested in that can find that in chapter 20. But in the epilogue, you take us into your own experience here, and you talk about your own trip to explore the question, what did Stanley see in the fall of 1875? Now, this is an extraordinarily powerful, moving part of the story, and it's an epilogue, but in many ways, it's really at the heart, I thought, as a reader, of what's going on here. So as a way, perhaps, to bring us toward our conclusion, can you talk about that experience? Sort of what for you was important and transformative about that experience in terms of how you look back on and think about the project?
I think by the end of the book, I felt like the important part of the story for me was tracing the rise and fall of this hypothesis, because we know so much about Nazi Germany, and we associate the term Aryan so much with that history. And yet this other racial theory, the Hamitic hypothesis, is in fact, much more expansive and longer lived than the short, violent years of the Third Reich. And yet it's made a profound influence on the world. And so the book itself is a kind of biography of that idea. But by the end of it, I was thinking, you know, but I can't, we still haven't really answered the question, well, what did Stanley see? What did other people see? What did Stephenson see when he looked at these people he describes as blonde Eskimos? Or what did Richard Marsh see when he went to Panama and found people he called white Indians? And so I felt like to do justice to this story, I had to offer some kind of at least speculative answer to that question, what did Stanley see? So I went to Uganda in 2013, and I kind of realized at the outset, you know, I don't really think there's a white tribe on the mountain. And I don't really think that the people who Stanley encountered would necessarily be in the regions that he described. So more than anything, I went to see the places he went and to just try to and I did some research also at the Makerere University in Kampala and spoke to some scholars there. But really, it was an attempt to try to think through this question. So I took a bus. I spent some weeks in Kampala, and then I took a bus to Western Uganda, which is Mount Gambarabagara is now called Mount Stanley. And it's a mountain that sits astride the border of Congo and Uganda. And for 8 days, I climbed this mountain with a guide, a Bakonjo man named William. And he took me up this mountain, and you know, I told him about this story of the white tribe, and he kind of laughed at me. He's like, you know, there's no white people on this mountain. you're the only white guy here. So it was, but I kind of had to climb it and see it, and it was a kind of profound experience for me because as much as I was, you know, had been planning this trip for years and was eager to do it, it was a very, very hard trip. I felt very alone on the mountain. And, you know, William was a fantastic guy, but I just felt very, very isolated. I could feel, in a sense, the world of, you know, my family and my neighborhood moving on, you know, without me. And I felt very homesick at points. And then when I summited this mountain at about 17,000 feet, it was very, very difficult. I mean, I thought I was in good shape, but I just couldn't eat. I couldn't eat anything. And on the first night after we summited, I had a kidney stone attack. So I was at about 15,000 feet, and we didn't have any, you know, medicine to speak of. And we're 6 days from, you know, base camp. And so I didn't feel like I was in any imminent danger of death, but I just felt, wow, I don't know how I'm going to get down from this. And that profound feeling of isolation, I thought, oh my God, you know, this is just 3 weeks in Africa that I put myself into, you know, and Stanley had to deal with this for 3 years when he was crossing Africa. And I think to come back to your question, one of the things that made me think of was, you know, Stanley was so profoundly lonely that he saw in people similarities to people he saw back home. There's a part of his narrative where he says, you know, I was walking by a guy and he looked just like Thomas Jefferson. And this other guy I walked by, he reminded me so much of this guy I knew back home. And it just struck me that in those places of pure isolation, we find the familiar. We're desperate for the familiar. And I kind of wonder whether in that state of mind, these explorers who are seeking desperately to connect what they see and experience to things that they know, saw whiteness. Because, you know, of course, when we talk about people as being white, we're not really talking about a color. We're talking about a whole constellation of of behaviors, of physical structures, of intonation, of language. I mean, you know, it just and I think that these were tripwires for these explorers. It was almost as if people's faces became a kind of Rorschach test, you know, for these explorers. And what they most wanted to see was people like them.
I think that's a beautiful point to move us to our conclusion, actually. So, Michael, there's a million billion things that we didn't have a chance to talk about, right? It's a very rich book, and we really just kind of skated along the surface and down the path. But given that, is there anything that we didn't have a chance to talk about but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
I think there's two things that I want to talk a little bit about. Well, the first one is that although this story seems so absurd to educated 21st century readers, like, really? What's going on? It's not treated as absurd in other parts of the world. If you go to India, if you go to East Africa, if you go to wet parts of West Africa even, there are many, many groups of people who identify their origins as non-indigenous, that there are Africans who see their origins as Mediterranean. There are Indians who see their origin as from outside of India, as essentially Aryan, from an earlier invasion. And so these stories are alive. They're not just some crazy fable that Europeans came up with and then put to rest after World War II. They're alive. They affect people. They are implicated in events of mass violence like the Rwandan genocide. And I think it's important that Western audiences especially realize that there are legacies of racial science that really exist outside of Europe and continue to influence the world. The other point I would say is that as much as these stories seem kind of crazy, this search for identity this is really a search for racial identity. But in many ways, when you look at modern day adventurous or modern day self-styled explorers, there's a sense in which people still believe that they can peel off the kind of mask of civilization to find some core identity unalloyed, beneath it. And while it's now politically incorrect to talk about it in terms of racial identity, and I think many people would feel very uncomfortable in talking about it, in many ways, what we do when we, you know, climb K2, or we try to do a traverse of Antarctica, or we move through through the Amazon basin, is very parallel to what Victorian explorers were doing in the late 19th century. We don't call it racial, but many of those same kind of quests for identity still exist. So I think those are the two reasons the two areas in which I think this story touches the present.
Great. Thank you. And now that the story is out in book form, and congratulations, I think it's clear that I love the book. I think it's fabulous. What's next for you? What are you currently inspired by and working on?
I am really interested in what happens to this thing we call exploration in the late 20th century and in our own time period. I think exploration really kind of had a meaning for Victorian explorers, and you get this feeling that there's this incredible identity crisis in what exploration means. Is exploration the summiting of a mountain? Well, no, not really. Is it something like if a rover crosses the surface of Mars? Well, it's not human. It's that. So I think the next project we'll be looking at this idea of exploration and focusing in particular on the connections between the human and the machine. I listened when you interviewed Janet for Tessie a few months ago, Carla, which was a terrific interview. And her book, Seeing Like a Rover, was one that I went out and picked up after I heard the interview. And it was it had a big impact on me because of the way that she describes for people who don't know the book. She basically is embedded with a rover team for years as they negotiate where to send these rovers over the surface of Mars. And this idea of seeing like a rover is really a kind of exploration of what happens to the human when the human is like receiving its information from an entity that doesn't perceive the world the way it does. And what are the kind of hybrid results that you see when you're trying to translate from robot perception to human perception? And I'm just completely fascinated by that. And I would love to look at that theme, not only as it's articulated, let's say, in planetary science, but also how do we do it in terms of satellite information about, like, say, Antarctica, for example, or in environmental studies, which increasingly use machines. So in a very vague sense, I know that's a kind of amorphous answer, but I would love to look at that connection between the human and the machine in exploration.
Awesome. So thank you so much. Thanks very much for making the time today, Michael. Congratulations on an awesome book. It was really a pleasure to talk to you about it.
Thank you, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very, very much for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.